Hi, and welcome to the How Not to Think podcast, the show that looks at everything from artificial intelligence to natural stupidity and everything in between. I have conversations with great guests from many different fields as we talk about things like binary thinking, cognitive bias, conventional wisdom, and so much more. I'm Dr. Howard Rankin. And if you're interested in these topics, I encourage you to check out my books on Amazon, including I Think, Therefore I'm Wrong, Intuitive Rationality, and a new book currently up for pre-sale, Falling to Grace, The Art and Science of Redemption. You can also find out more about me and connect with me at drhowardjrankin.com. Today's guest comes to me all the way from the neighboring state of North Carolina. Horacio Sanchez is an expert and leader in the subject of neuroscience in education and the challenges that education faces. Delighted, Horacio, to have you with us today.
Happy to be here, Howard.
Yeah. So we always start with the first question, which is, how did you get to be where you are working in this field?
Oh, almost by accident. I have a mental health and an education background. And when I was director of mental health in North Carolina, we started doing research on resiliency and developed the first resiliency-based public sector mental health initiative. And we took some of the most severely disturbed of our clientele, and we focused on projecting protective factors as a course of treatment for severe emotional disabilities. And that, if you're familiar with the theory, resiliency theory says, as your protective factors increase, your presenting problems diminish. But it was a theory at that time. And so we applied it and tracked the outcome of all the folks we did it with. We started having success, and then people kept on asking, well, why is it having such success? And it kept on pushing us backwards. And as it pushed us backwards, we started backtracking protective factors and its impact on the brain. And at that time, what was happening was there was some work that was going on in Sweden. And in the early days of oxytocin, and remember back then, we used to think oxytocin was involved with just lactation. And then we found out it was the bonding hormone. And then we also found out that when oxytocin rises, it actually reduces stress. So it's one of our ways of naturally regulating stress, our relationships. So resiliency always said we had to build relationship with students first, and then we had to do other things. And as we studied, it seemed like every protective factor improved brain function, and it pushed us in that direction. So naturally, when I went back to education, I thought it prudent to think about the fact that since we operate on the brains of educators, we probably should know more about it. And we started looking at it. And what I found out in the early days was that the neuroscience was here, and education was here. And when education heard about neuroscience, it was like, well, it sounds interesting, but how does it apply to us? Because it's just a bunch of brain theory stuff. So what I started trying to do was try to make it do this and connect. And feeling I could do both because of my mental health background and because of my education background, my goal wasn't to explain neuroscience to educators. My goal was to help educators apply neuroscience.
Excellent. And so what did some of that look like in terms of in the classroom or wherever you were applying it? Can you give us some sense of what that looked like that was different?
So one of the things that you start to look at is, some basic things like teachers are trying to improve kids' comprehension or kids' memories. And we started to have to figure out, well, how are memories formulated? And one of the things we know about memories is sleep is dramatically important. And if you notice, one of the things that you see happening now in real time in sleep studies is that the hippocampus, which is in charge of short-term memory, relays information repeatedly to the prefrontal cortex to help formulate new memories. So one of the things that's critical in memory formation is repetition. One of the things that happened in education a while back is that there was this theory that rogue repetition of things is low-level cognitive work. And as a result, we should reduce it in education and stick to the higher level stuff. Well, that's wonderful if you have the information, but anybody knows if you can't remember anything, how do you put it together? So one of the things we started understanding is since the hippocampus was so much involved with formation of memories, we found out that the hippocampus actually wasn't a word processor initially. The hippocampus was a sensory processor. And we know that because man was on the face of the earth for a long time without language. So it was processing senses. And what seems to be true now in all the studies that people are looking at is that the more senses that are tapped simultaneously, the greater the ability to create recall and information and memory formation. So if you start to think of tapping more senses, the need for repetition, and then also the hippocampus seems not to really enjoy a lot of language, the reduction of language to key things so you can actually make it in smaller chunks seems to help the brain formulate. So if teachers understand that, they start to think about how do I actually tap more senses with information I want to kids to remember, but how do I also reduce it? And how do I also create a way where there's enough repetition for kids, especially the kids that don't do homework and don't come from homes where mom and dad are helping them and doing a lot of work.
Right. Yeah.
So that's an example.
Yeah. No, fascinating. And you found that that was beneficial, I'm sure.
Yeah. That there are so many things that are beneficial. We found out that the brain actually utilizes the body to help us understand abstract concepts. So if that's the case, we started saying, okay, well, why don't we just utilize the body when teaching abstract concepts? And so I do that in training, actually, and I model it and people go, oh, I get it. So it's not as hard as you think, but you think using the body. What one of the things that happened in education that I think is really sad is that a lot of the fun things we used to do and a lot of the things that were engaging, we kind of think, well, we should do that in elementary. And then after that, as we get older, it should be boring. So I don't believe that. And I know it's not true because if you look at people who present, the people who present in a way that's engaging and uses the science and has movement and all these other things, people love them far more than the people who sit down and do a lecture. So if you start to think about just how what you like and what you found engaging, I guarantee you was situations where people did some of the things that the brain really wants.
Yeah, no question about that. And, you know, it's unfortunate that it seems that education has been based on really the opposite of you know, certainly my education was in Britain. I went to a very well-respected, great boys' school, all boys' school, for my middle and high school education. But pretty much that's what it was. There wasn't much movement. There wasn't much entertainment. It was, I'm telling you this, and you're going to remember it, and repeat it in the exam.
That is perfectly fine when you have a collection of very bright people. I went to a high school that creamed off the top people in the state. And what we had was a bunch of people who were self-motivated to learn. And basically what our school taught us was how to teach yourself in many ways, how to become a learner. So by the time I got to college, I didn't really need to go to classes. I just knew how to learn. And so I could go to the library and learn myself. So that's great. but I think that is not the nature of education for the majority of folks. And I also think there's so much that goes into formulating an opinion that people don't think about. For example, everyone's sitting around here thinking like, well, I'm a thinker and I have this cognitive capacity, and they forget that 80% of what's going on is subconscious. And it's influencing your cognitive thought, whether you like it or not, but you're not aware of it. So one of the things we started understanding is like, let's say you're a person who starts things and never finishes. You start and never finish. You start and never finish. Once that pattern is created, when you're sitting in a classroom and the minute something gets difficult, we now know that your subconscious brain is giving you an information that's saying, quit, because you already established the pattern and it does it. And we know that happens because when we looked at folks who had were subjected to some kind of emotional abuse, there's a famous attorney who reached very high levels in the law, and she became a judge. And she talks about the fact that in spite of all that she achieved, her father used to always say to her, she would achieve nothing. And she talks about every time she got lower, anytime something went bad, that message played in her head. And that was conscious for her because it was her conscious, but that also plays subconsciously. And I think one of the things we started to understand about the human brain is that the subconscious influence becomes so much more that we need to interpret and understand, because it influences so much of what we do. So all the work that's being done right now on implicit bias, in some ways, is good, but in some ways it's laughable, because one of the things we know about implicit bias is that it's subconscious. Therefore, one of the things we started understanding is, unless you understand how the brain produces it, if your awareness increases your attention, when your attention increases, what used to be subconscious, some of it can become conscious. But what we do with implicit bias is, people study the outcome of it. They go like, well, implicit bias causing this, this, and this. But if you don't know how it does it, all you do is reject it, because you go, well, I don't think that.
Right. No, absolutely. Yes. And again, as you rightly say, people logically don't understand the impact of the subconscious. Things that are happening that they're not even aware of, and putting them into awareness and making them aware of that is the first step. It's not sufficient for change, but it's the first step towards understanding and then changing, if you are so motivated. But awareness is really critical, and people are not aware a lot of the times, especially of the negative messages they give themselves, right?
Right.
And I'm sure working in the education system, you've seen it many times. I've seen it working with kids and teenagers and adults, really, where people say, oh, I'm so useless at this, you know. And mm-hmm. they're really, I'm thinking of some cases in the education system where kids weren't, you know, and didn't have great verbal memory and couldn't repeat or remember the history and dates, but they were phenomenal with their hands. They could create amazing art, you know, and have to work with them saying, well, that may not be your strong suit, but look what you're great at, you know? And, you know, if it's not on the curriculum, you're left to feel, well, I'm not smart.
and good curriculums incorporate it, because if you've seen those, there's a movement now, it's called sketch notes. And it's basically using little drawings and the key words to create your notes. And for kids who process that way, it is wonderful. But it's wonderful for anybody, because anybody looks at those, they go like, I get it quicker because it's so much better. And it's not just flat. And so that's what we try to get people to consider. Have kids do it that way. Have students consider those things. Capitalize on all the ways the brain does what it does better. And I think if we do that, we end up so much better. And when you were talking about negative message, one of the things that came to mind was there was some research done on inner speech. And, you know, we all engage in inner speech, and inner speech is actually supposed to be productive, supposed to help us overcome things. When they studied inner speech, there was some really cool things that happened. One, when you actually engage in inner speech, all the systems activate like if you're speaking. But that was not shocking to us because, you know, subconscious thought, motor neurons moving, mm-hmm. that's not surprising. Mm-hmm. What was surprising is your auditory system lit up like it was hearing it.
Mm.
And the chemical impact of the message followed what you were inner saying to yourself. So if the message was positive, your chemical disposition was improved. If the message was negative, the chemical disposition was hindered. And if you start to think about people who really struggle with things, one of the things is inner speech. They say so many messages to themselves. So angry kids usually get angrier. Sadder kids get sadder. And one of the things we're trying to get teachers to understand is that we can teach kids the power of inner speech and have them start to cognitively try to change the message so we can combat some of those things. And if they know that it can work because how it works in their brain right now, they can start to work on those things in a little better way. So some of those things is helping teachers just understand what are messages we tell kids. And it's not just the curriculum, it's other things like we try to teach kids what happens when you meet someone for the first time in people's brains and what makes the brain relax and what makes the brain get alerted. And one of the things that makes the brain relax is smiling, shock. One of the things that makes the brain relax is finding something you have in common. So think about the people you've met for the first time and you had a conversation. The next thing you go, oh, really? You went to Duke? My son goes to Duke. Any commonality just makes us feel better. And the kids who struggle oftentimes don't find commonality or focus on differences.
Yes.
And we try to teach them the opposite. Smile to disarm and find commonalities and make your brain happier. And that's especially important when kids are thrown in there with kids who are very different than them, because the brain is already alerted to differences.
Yep.
And differences makes the amygdala on alert till it feels like it's safe. And so if we can make people know how to disarm and how to engage in the conversation that calms the amygdala and makes us happier, we can get along with a wide range of people. And it's a skill set that we have to teach kids now, because the sad thing is what me and you are doing right now, which is a conversation. Conversation is becoming a novelty because people talk, people say things, people hear. That's not what I'm talking about.
Right.
I'm talking about a conversation. Right. The number one way of communicating right now is texting, and it doesn't substitute for this type of conversation.
No.
It reduces the skill set that we need to become good at this social interaction stuff.
No question about that. And I think it's one reason why one of the side effects of social media has been more divisiveness, because that is not a real conversation.
No, and all the research shows without that face-to-face interaction, we can be crueler. Mm-hmm. We would do things that we would never do face-to-face.
Right.
It also shows that people who tend to become more isolated and just go towards social media, they actually, their chances of mental illness and high-risk behavior just jumps. There was a study done on girls, and one of the things that constantly happened in girls who just closed off and went towards social media was high rates of depression. And it's not a substitute for real relationships. And I think lots of people think it is a substitute. It's a supplement, not a substitute.
Yes.
And you know, supplements don't keep you alive. They're supposed to, you supplement what you're supposed to really, you need a good diet and then you can have a supplement. You know, like I eat crap food and then I take a supplement, you know?
Yeah, perhaps it should be called on social media, really, because the emphasis on the social is very misleading because it's not face-to-face. It's not a, it's not a conversation.
It's also not a conversation. Someone asked me to comment on something on Twitter. And the question the person posed to me was a question that if you responded in a soundbite, the chances of being misunderstood and someone saying something in rebuttal or response was going to be very high. So my response was, this is not the appropriate medium for this conversation. And he got pissed.
Of course. And then he blocked you.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. But these are such critical things and real danger of going down the wrong rabbit hole with the development of, hey, the metaverse is coming, right? Facebook is going to be able to connect you with people all over the world. Even though if you've got 5,000 friends on Facebook, they'll only let, you know, 10 see your post, but they're going to connect you. Again, it's just unrealistic. It is not natural. And no, we're missing the critical things which actually make interaction social.
Yeah, and also improves our skill set. We started looking at, like, how do people develop and the ability to read people's faces, and infants can pick up things like happy and sad very quickly. By around 9 to 10, we start to be able to have a greater accuracy in interpreting. The ability to respond to people's facial needs doesn't even kick into like 13 or 14. We hit that peak in our adulthood. But one of the things that we started noticing is all these age paradigms assume two things: a safe environment to mature in, and in quantity and quality of social interaction. Kids who don't have those things in sufficient amounts end up with a drop in ability to read people. And even though they are much older, their social capacity is not equal to their age. Yeah. And that's what we're seeing a lot right now, because, and the other thing the people don't think about is that all the things that the brain reads in relation to nonverbals is the foundations of empathy. So when you reduce that occurrence, you reduce empathy, which is one of the reasons I think we're getting such a, we have such a callous kind of thing going on more with younger kids. Kids is that empathy has been dropping. And I think one of the causes is the reduction of this. It's enough social interaction so that my skill sets develop. So I become in tune to reading people's faces, voice tones, gestures. And I think the lacking of that makes people like callous and less willing to help each other, understand each other, or care about each other. And I think we need to be careful about that, because empathy is critical. It is the foundation of humans.
Yep. No, absolutely. The first essay I had to do as an undergraduate in psychology was, how can intergroup conflict be reduced? And the obvious way is getting together and sitting around the table and getting to know each other. But that requires the sort of set of skills that you're talking about. And, you know, there may be an app where you can hold it up to someone's face and it'll tell you what they're feeling, but that's not quite the same.
It doesn't work the same. No, not at all. A matter of fact, in the real advanced work that they're doing empathy right now, the term cooperation is an outcome of empathy. And if you start to really dissect it, we are capable more of cooperating with those we are empathetic with, and we tend to be uncooperative with those we're unempathetic with. So when man got into clans initially, the ability to be empathetic is what helped us to cooperate with each other and progress. And if you look at divisiveness, or if you look at or this negative engagement, usually if you dig down at the root of it is a lack of empathy. And limiting empathy to only those who you agree with or look like it's been detrimental to our society. The highest, most evolved form of empathy is the ability to be empathized with those you don't actually comprehend their emotion. It's easy for me to empathize for certain things I've felt. My mother passed away not that long ago. And before that, if someone I worked with lost a parent, I knew they felt bad and I knew it felt bad. But after my mother passed, I now truly understand what they're feeling.
Right.
Okay. That's a simple way of empathy. But the highest form of empathy is you're going through something. I comprehend it none at all, but I care for you enough to feel that I'm concerned about you, even though I don't understand it at all.
Right. Yep.
And that's what I find is the form that's missing the most, because it seems that disagreement is right now licensed for no empathy. We disagree, so I'm not empathetic with you.
Right. Absolutely. And that's completely right. I've been working with a guy who's a big humanitarian, a Israeli-American from New Jersey, who, for all sorts of personal reasons, very empathic, compassionate person, been trying to help in Syria, now helping in Afghanistan, given up amazing amounts of his time, effort, money, put himself at risk. And there's people who just diss him. He's only doing it for his... And it's interesting, I read a piece recently about, people who do good very often get criticized because they're being almost, quotation mark, too nice. But you're right. This is, you're absolutely right. It's easy to empathize with somebody who's experienced something you know about and have been through.
Right.
The challenge is, I don't get it, but I'm still feeling your pain. Right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that allows me to empathize with you, even though our experiences are different, even though you haven't experienced some of the things I have and I've experienced some of the things you have. And that, in that comes cooperation, but also in that comes tolerance. And I think we need to be a little bit more concerned. That's why I almost think empathy needs to be in our curriculum. How does the brain produce it? How is it developed? How important it is in comprehension of the humanities. For example, one of the things we're seeing now is that if your empathy scores are lower, your comprehension of literature drops down. Think about it logically.
Sense. Yeah.
When we hit words that have emotion, our brain produces feelings, and it is the depth of the emotion in the literature that moves. So I tell people, raise your hand if you've been reading a passage that drove you to tears. People raise their hand. Have you been reading a book and sometimes chuckle because it was funny and you... And now think about reading a book that's supposed to make you jump out of your seat, but you feel nothing, or reading a book that's supposed to drive you to tears and you feel nothing, or a book that's humorous and you feel nothing. At the end, what is your comprehension? Because your comprehension drops because you've reduced it nothing to words and definitions. And it's akin to this. Kids with autism, one of the things we've seen is the motor neurons in their brains are less operative. And the motor neurons help us mimic, and the mimicking helps us to feel things because we're actually going through the same expressions or movements. Well, you can tell a kid with autism what a word, the emotional word, is in definition, but the lack of feeling it makes it just robotic, and therefore the depth of comprehension is what's lost. And I think that's what's being lost somewhat in literature, because the greatest works of literature aren't there to make you just think. Greatest works of literature are instill passion. And people forget about that passion need, because I remember the TED talk of one of the world's foremost mathematicians, and one of his things was, everybody thinks math is dry and math is flat. The thing that makes me a great mathematician is because I'm passionate about it. He says, numbers move me sometimes to tears, or they make me joyous when I figure something out. It's passion. It's not flat. And that's what learning is. And I think people who understand that get to the place where this is wonderful stuff. I've had this great experience. Reason girls pick up books and read them earlier and at earlier age is because language is more evolved and girls are excited to see what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Until you get to the place where you understand it and comprehend it, the motivation is very different. And I think one of the things we're seeing more is that kids who have lower empathy are really struggling with the passion part of learning because it's missing. It's just flat. And one of the sad things we're seeing now with poverty is poverty's impacts empathy. So you're hurting these kids in multiple ways. One of the ways is lack of resources, greater impact to their brain, but even things like lower empathy. So a lot of the things that help us to just move it along is lost. But and one of the differences is there is a difference between the majority of girls who have more of a female structured brains and poverty and boys, because girls seem to have a better capacity for language because of brain structure and functioning. If they have a female structured brain, they seem to be able to offset some of the deficits that poverty produces. It seems to impact boys a little bit stronger because the impact on the language is far more severe. And to be able to do well at school right now, if you look at school the way it's structured right now, language and memory are the two ingredients you need.
Absolutely.
Well, the female brain, for majority of females who have a female structured brain, because not all women have a female structured brain, the advantage they have is language, and the other advantage is detailed memory. Both of those things are there. And if you think about, once we let women into education because we blocked them for a while, the reason education is being now dominated by women is because it was built for them. The way we do education right now, language and detail memory advantage. And now we have more women teaching. And some of the things that we used to have in the past were some more interactive kinds of hands-on kind of things lowered because of that, because if you already have advantage in language and memory, you teach that way. Mm-hmm. And I find that the folks who are losing most in schools tend to be the boys who don't learn that way. And the sad part is some of the most advanced curriculum right now is hands-on, mm-hmm. but we use it with the most advanced kids. So if you look at the most advanced science, the STEM movement, it is hands-on interactive learning. We are using it with the brightest kids
who probably don't need it as much, for sure, right?
Yeah. You need to do that with all kids.
Yeah, no question about that. And there's no question that learning in any setting, formal or otherwise, is about engagement and getting your engagement and interest and excitement. If you don't have that, blah, 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 I'm not going to remember it, I don't care, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what you see. You may have heard me, I don't know whether I mentioned this on our podcast with Andrea Somdy, but I used to ask all the clients that I had when I was in practice who were in any sort of education setting what their favorite subject was. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the time, not always, of course, but a lot of the time they came back with the same answer. That was not a subject and it wasn't recess. And I actually asked this when I was up at a Yale think tank with David Katz, was one of the participants, and two or three other people from the Yale School of Education. So I said, what do you think the answer is? And I didn't quite get it. The answer is a subject taught by my favorite teacher. A subject taught by the teacher that I have the best connection with. You know, that is what is going to excite me. That is what is going to get me engaged. And that's probably what I'm going to be good at. Because
we do, we do climate assessments at schools, and it's really detailed work. And in that, we interview almost every adult in the school. We ask them, we say, what is your favorite subject? And one of the things that we found out of that is two things. One is what you mentioned. The one that's taught by the teacher that they are more engaged and feel best about, or the subject that they're more successful in, because we get self-motivation from success. So right now we find that kids will migrate to what they're good at. And the thing that helps us to get over that or take on a challenge or like something that we did not like sometimes has to do with how well do I get along with the instructor? So I know lots of people who hated math and was engaged in math because of the teacher. So when we really have good capacity, success, you know, that's motivating enough because we have a pattern of success. We'll get through it. We're self-motivated in those subjects. If you have kids go home, they'll do the subjects they're good in first for homework because they have self-motivation. But I find that ingredient of teacher connection rapport piece is critical for kids to engage in something that they would have never thought they were interested in, or in something that they don't think they're good at. And that becomes the big deal. And I find lots of people got good at things or started liking something because of the teacher and that rapport bit business and that empathy piece and all those kind of things. So I find that the two things are there. If we can build patterns of success, we build self-motivated learners. But oftentimes for the kids who aren't there yet, that critical piece is the one you just mentioned. It seems like the teacher is the thing that motivates them and they're more important than they really are. And one of the things, because education is becoming complex now and a lot of teachers are struggling more because they can be in a classroom that's really difficult with so much going on. And what can be lost for teachers right now is that how important they are in the scheme of things and how much building rapport with students, how significant that is for enabling the brain to do a lot of things that it wouldn't do without them. And I think it's just sad. And I think sometimes if you were familiar with education 40 years ago, then 20 years ago now, teachers, the life of a teacher and the things that they're asked to do is actually overwhelming. Now, it's not that we didn't do a lot before. So if I look hours-wise, when I was teaching back then and what I would do now, the hours are just the same, but the things that I'm asked to do are different. So some of the things that I'm forced to do that take up my time don't necessarily have to do with teaching. They have to do with things I have to record, things I have to do, putting all these things in, there's so much extra stuff involved. Right. And a lot of the time when I was spent, all my extra time was spent on my lesson and teaching and preparing. A lot of extra time is spent for teachers doing other things. And some of the other things that we used to do in the old days that was helpful, people don't do now in hopes of actually saving time. So for example, when I was teaching at high school level, I still went and ate with students. No one does it anymore. They do it in grade school, but they don't do it at higher levels. We used to be in the hallways all the time, monitoring kids, encouraging them to come in the class on time and things like that. Well, in the interest of time, in the interest of time saving, because things are so overwhelming, we've given teachers that out and they don't have to monitor hallways now. But a lot of the casual observations and the learning of what's going on with students often came for me in those unstructured kinds of times. And we have found out that, you know, they've give you give the over now, they have people who they hire just to be hall monitors. Well, the hall monitors don't have relationships with the kids. And so now you have someone who doesn't know the kids trying to move them along in the most unstructured time, which is a disaster. But you're missing the critical opportunities sometimes to engage with students in these times, because lunchroom and hallway times, I found out a lot of stuff. I would sit with kids and find out stuff that I would have never found out. Absolutely. That was going on with their life or something like that. And so those are the things that I find used to carry me, because some of the kids that people thought were really difficult to teach, I got along with because I knew so much more about them. And we sat down and, you know, we've swapped food, you know, we've like, absolutely. Oh, you want to taste this, you know?
Yeah.
I saw him in the hall and, you know, I'm like, gee, man, you're hobbling today. What's going on with you? I hurt my leg. And you know, those are things that I think are critical. But to be fair, wasn't asked to do some of the things teachers are doing right now.
Right.
That is extra stuff. And I think that's what I find about every aspect of education. They're doing more stuff, but it may not necessarily be related to teaching.
Correct. So, no, that's true. And you find that in a lot of fields. And one of those fields is medicine, where doctors are spending a ton of time filling out records and doing bureaucracy. And the rate of burnout in doctors is incredibly high because of that. They don't have the time. They would much rather be spending that time with their patients. You know, that's what they didn't sign up to fill out mm-hmm. forms. And I would suspect.
But also, that's an interesting thing. The shift in the training for medicine because of that kind of stuff started to create people who were more engaged in this kind of diagnosis, all this stuff. But if you notice now what's happening in medical schools across the nation, they haven't to come back and teach them bedside manners and social engagement mm-hmm. again, because mm-hmm. the emphasis just on the science they found out as a problem. Because how do you make a diagnosis? Well, one of the reasons you need information, and most of the information needs to come from, the patient who may not talk to you because they don't feel they're connected or feel that
exactly.
They can.
No, exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah. And that same thing happened in education. And if you look at the training for education, then we migrated away from teaching and student rapport to the just the science of learning or the curriculum itself. And part of teaching is the art of teaching. You know, like one of the things that makes me a good teacher is me actually knowing how to teach, and people don't spend a lot of time on how do you deliver a lesson in a way that captures people. It's how do you manage a curriculum and how do you dispense it and how do you grade and how do you assess?
Right. Right.
And so I think the art part is when you lose the art part of it, you lose so much and you end up going backwards. And that's what happened in the field of medicine. Doctors started figuring out we have a problem, and now you have to create a course to teach doctors to talk to patients.
That's exactly right. I'm creating a course on communication for professionals, a lot with physicians in mind, but it would apply really to any professionals, because so many, and I was one of them, which prompted me to go do this research and write books about it, so many people, I mean, nobody's ever really given a course in communication, really, I don't think, unless you're in marketing, maybe, but that's perhaps a different thing. But, mm-hmm. you know, you could be the most skilled physician in the world, but if you don't know how to communicate to people, that means nothing. It means right. nothing. And then you could be the wisest teacher in the classroom, you know, in the school, but if you can't communicate, that gets lost.
Yes.
And it's almost like this sort of extra social interaction that you're talking about, that should be a priority to
exactly.
get to know the kids, to get them to see you as something different than somebody standing up giving them a C grade or whatever it is. Right. And in that essence, that human essence is really what you're talking about.
Right.
And I know,
but I think we create our own problems, because I think how we created the emphasis in training started to produce that. It's what happened in medicine. It's what happened in education. The training shifted from where do we emphasize? The training shifted to the emphasis away from the student to the curriculum itself. And the same thing happened to doctors. It was in the emphasis of dispensing your ability, your science, rather than to how do you dispense? How do you do this? Because, you know, I used to sit down. I had to make diagnosis. I had to do all this stuff. And I was well aware my diagnosis is only as good as the information I have. And if I can't get the information and fill in these gaps, I'm going to end up doing what is the scattergun approach of what is the most safe thing possible to diagnose and prescribe, hit it against the wall, and then see the repercussions to kind of fine tune it. And it's how we do mental health medicine anyway right now, is because we don't have enough time to really hone in on the precise problem, and we try to give the medicine that medication that has the least chance of bad outcome. Right. But you and I both know now we can look at the brain. You can have 100 cases of depression and they all impact 100 different areas. Depression is not like a lot of other things. It actually so wide in the brain that what we prescribe as a medicine for it could not even be close for this person, but maybe perfect for this person.
Right. So yeah, no, exactly.
It's fine tuning this stuff. And so I found out if you spent more time getting every piece of information you could, your chances of diagnosing and prescribing were 100 times better. And that's the same thing. I find the more you understand and know about students, the easier it is. I tell teachers, and when I train them, is that the brain understands new concepts best when you can connect it to things that you know really, really well. One of the tricks we used to use to make kids think a bunch of new stuff was really easy was I used to poll my kids every year and say, what do you spend the most time doing? And I had them put the top three things. And usually, if you start to look at it, they came back in clusters because most of the kids were doing the same stuff. Well, there were times when I knew exactly what they were doing because it was stuff I did. But then time started changing. And then they came back and were talking about things like video games. I didn't do video games, but I had to study video games. And what I would do is when I would introduce new things, I would make illustrations and connections to video gaming or things that they were doing a lot of. And they'll go like, oh, yeah, that's easy.
That's right.
And they were like, oh, his class is so easy. You know? But I was doing advanced stuff, but I was connecting it for them, and they were able to make the connections easily. And and that's just a trick. It's just me understanding this is what the human brain does. And when it can do this, comprehension goes up. But I had to do what? I had to spend time finding out what my kids were doing. And it wasn't much time, but it was valuable time.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. I mean, if you can connect with what's already there and set up in the brain, great. You're not having to start new things. You're just adding to what is already there. Now that makes it easy. And, you know, you theoretically, I think you could teach almost any topic. You know, I had a dad once say, oh, my kid's not interested in school. All he's interested in is basketball. You could teach him everything you'd need to know using basketball.
Yes.
Metaphors, analogies. You could teach math, geography, history,
exactly.
Science, everything. The problem obviously becomes, you know, when you're teaching a group of people, then how do you match all those individuals? Or perhaps you get all the people who are interested in basketball in one group and teach them that way. But
usually you find enough clusters. I used to have like 3 or 4 clusters, and I'll touch them all. But I think people make these things complicated. But if they start to think about this, if you become really good at anything in life, like if you're a really great chef, believe me, you see life through the lens of cooking. And I've been around some great cooks, and guess what? everything that happens, they relate to cooking. Mm-hmm. Just everything that happens in my life, I relate to the brain. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, me and my wife were driving one time and I saw a squirrel, but you know how squirrels start to cross and then panic and so back. And I turned to her and I go, "Bitty cortex, big amygdala." Well, this is the way I see the world. You know, it's like I see the world this way. And so everything to me relates to the way the brain functions, mm-hmm. and how it works as it relates to behavior. And I think if we just understood that, we'd be able to say, okay, we already do this. And this is the way humans do it. So let's spend some time and find out what people already know a lot about. And let's start to make sure that when we dispense really challenging things, we relate it to the things they know a lot about so they can go, oh, that's easy. And it's funny because I talk about the brain stuff and some of it's really complex stuff. And people go to my trainings and they don't leave going, "That was overwhelming. I didn't understand anything." Some of them leave like, "Oh, that was really easy," because I kept on associating it to things I knew they knew about. And so it was like,
absolutely. They were
like, "Oh, I get it. That's not complicated." But no. If I just said only things like amygdala, the hippocampus, corpus callosum, the left hemisphere, right?
Yeah, you lost them. Yeah, no, that's right. I'm interested because I'm a brain guy too. When you said to your wife about the squirrel's amygdala, what did she do? Did she roll her eyes or did she?
No. She spent so much time with me. She speaks it too.
Well, lucky for you. Mine's not so generous, but that's okay. Awesome. We could continue forever, I'm sure. Amazing stuff, Horacio. What you're doing is fantastic, I think. You have a book, too. Tell us a little bit about the book.
My last book? Yeah. My most recent book is The Poverty Problem, and it's really concerning a pretty significant shift in brain function related to poverty. Now, understand, there's always been some impact in the brain based on poverty, but it used to be more focused on and related to things like the impact of poverty and the diet on the brain and development, things like that. But what we're finding right now is that poverty, and if you track it in developed countries, seem to be having a pretty consistent impact on brain function and brain development. For example, there is a fairly high consistent occurrence of lower gray matter in the prefrontal cortex, a different alteration to the size and function of the amygdala and the hippocampus, which are critical, one for emotion and one for learning. The prefrontal cortex is the top-down control. There is an impact of white matter, which has to do with our ability to communicate between regions. And some of the hemispheres that are most impacted have to do with language and social behavior. So we're seeing pretty consistent impact in relation to size and function. And if you start to think that impact and then correlate it to school performance, it's pretty consistent. The poor have always done poor in school. That's not surprising. Mm-hmm. What's happening is it's growing. So for years, for the last 10 years, probably, or maybe 20 years, America has been focused on the achievement gap, which is focused on the white and the black. The reality is the biggest gap we currently have is the economic gap. If you look closely, the economic gap in learners is larger. The reason people aren't focused on it as much as they should is because so much of a high concentration of poverty is minorities. So therefore, right. You're still looking at just the gap in relation to race, but you're missing the point. One of the issues may be far more the economics of it than this focus on race, the race of it. Okay. So the book really starts to look at what is happening in the brain, but more importantly, every single chapter tells teachers and educators concretely what they can do to correct that or to address that or to compensate. And the beautiful thing about the brain is there are things you can do and it no longer is an issue where you're just compensating. the brain can change. The brain is a healer. The brain can do a lot of things to correct things like density if you're exposed to the right things. And I think that's what we want people to do. Do the right things for these kids who are struggling so that you not only help them compensate, but help their brains actually rewire, restructure, and become healthier. And if they do it earlier and often, especially when it comes to the human brain, is it's easier to correct things sooner than later. Right. And so it's not that it can't.
Can be,
but
yeah.
Everything
that's right.
changes. You know, our plasticity goes down, our neurogenesis slows.
Right,
it's
right.
a lot harder doing changes in our age than it would be if we were in kindergarten. And so trying to get people to consider those things and address them rather than just say there's a problem, and recognizing the problem's not what we want to do. We want to recognize the solutions. So absolutely. That's what my last book was on.
The poverty problem. Yeah, absolutely. When I was doing some research in a school district in Missouri that was pretty low socioeconomic status, I remember this conversation I had. School started, it was elementary school. School started like at 7:30. And so this mom came in, single mom, of course. And, your son really needs to be in bed by, 8 o'clock at the latest. And she said, "What? I don't get home from work till 10:30. You know, right there, there is exactly the problem, right?
Different reality.
So the kid's not getting appropriate sleep, and everything else flows from that. And those lifestyle factors are huge in shaping the brain. But as you say, fortunately, we know that if you can get into a structure that changes that, then the brain will change. And as you say, as you get older, that's a little more problematic. Still possible, as I like to say.
Possible till you die.
I know. What I like to say, you can teach an old dog new tricks, but it probably won't forget the old ones. So that's the poverty problem. And I know you have other books too, one on education, right? The Revolution?
The Education Revolution was my one right before that. We basically looked at a lot of the changes that were happening in the adolescent brain or in children's brains based on our society as a whole, and how to start to deal with those kinds of things. And it talked, a lot of it was about learning and the process, but it also included things like what really happens in this issue of bullying and how it's migrated. For example, bullying actually has changed in our new world. We still have the old bully who wants to punch you in the face, but the highest occurrence of bullying is actually girls using technology to then isolate another female or to spread things about them. And it talks about how these things are occurring and why, and things that we can do about it. Because interesting notations, if you just tell students that about new forms of bullying, the occurrence of bullying actually goes up. It's not telling them that what is happening. It's telling them it's increasing. It's actually helping them to understand things like empathy and social engagement that lowers bullying, not this linear thing of, let me teach you how all these kids are bullying people. And they tell them all these things and they're like, now the occurrence goes up. So we see, we even did things like that. And we also started really talking, there's even a chapter on diet and the whole issue of eating and the addiction parts of it, and how our society and our habits now have created kids who are basically self-medicating on foods with high sugars and fats, because we've created a paradigm in which everything in our society based on how foods are manufactured, produced, and it's designed to create habitual negative patterns. And it actually does impact the brain in a very negative way. I mean, if you start to track all the studies on diet and brain function, it's just hand in hand. So just helping parents and teachers know how the brain has been changing over the course of our lives and how to address the newer issues that are happening in, with students, regardless of race and income. And that's what that book was really focused on. And it did very well. The poverty problem is just timely right now because poverty is an overwhelming issue, and it's become even more severe because coming out of the pandemic, poverty's hit a whole new high. And so that is big. And the other thing the poverty problem would really help people do is to probably address this issue of race and culture in a more scientific and accurate way. And I think that's important because I find that topics that are complex, like racial relationships, people want to come out of and do something with it because of all the stuff that was happening in the media, they want to come and say, okay, let's address it. And oftentimes, if you don't understand really how the problem is produced, we end up oftentimes unintentionally doing something that actually exacerbates the problem. And it doesn't necessarily work that way. And we found that out in climate assessments in many cases where schools were focused on things like improving social interaction and addressing diversity. They put in programs that actually agitated the amygdala. And when we polled the folks, people thought it was worse after them addressing them before they addressed it. And that's just because they didn't understand the science. And if you could address all those things if you approached it differently, but they approach it in a way that agitated the amygdala and caused people to actually become more emotional and less cognitive. And that's not a good solution to help us get along better, make people emotional, angry.
No. Unfortunately, though, we live in a world where the media is designed to do just that. So that's a major problem. And definitely a subject for a future podcast. Finally, where can people reach you if they wanted to reach out to you?
My company is Resiliency Inc. And so my website's Resiliency Inc. And I'm on all the social platforms, on Twitter, on Facebook, and on LinkedIn, even Instagram.
That's awesome. Horacio, thank you so much, first of all, for all your work. Amazing stuff you're doing. Totally on the mark. And thank you for spending your time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me, Howard. And, you know, we engaged in something that I think is good, a conversation.
There you go. Take care.
You too, buddy.